On a recent Saturday night, I went to my neighborhood twin movie theater to see Total Recall. But the air conditioning was broken, so I went to a nearby multiplex. The sound was so low I could barely make out what was being said, and the popcorn was so stale I didn't finish it. What happened to the fun of going to the movies? My guest Douglas Gummery has charted the history of the American movie theater and how we got from the movie palace of the 20s to the shopping mall multiplex of today. His essay on the subject is included in the new book, Seeing Through Movies. He told me what he doesn't like about multiplexes.
What I don't like is that it's too stripped down. It's just we don't have the multi-sensorious experience that we used to have with the movie palaces. And so at its best, you just get a movie in focus and the sound. At its worst, you get sticky floors and the sound not working too well, and the image often out of focus.
Well, how did movie theaters end up moving to shopping malls?
The movie industry reluctantly but slowly followed the crowd. So as people moved into the suburbs and built those houses and in the 1950s, first response was to have drive-ins. And we probably remember those, the large farmers' fields converted into what some people called passion pits, and they were popular in the 50s, but then as more and more stores were built, they first built theaters on the parking lots of shopping centers, and then as these gigantic malls that were self-enclosed and climate-controlled and their own worlds, really, started being built, which is the late 60s, early 70s, they started adding first one or two theaters kind of on the corner, and then the ones that are being built today all have 10, 12. There's one in Michigan that has 28.
Wow. What are the economics behind the multiplex where there's like 4, 6, 10, 12, 20 theaters?
It's to keep the, in the first place, it's to keep the cost down. You need one, two, maybe three projectionists at most, hence the problems with projections. You need one candy counter. Some of them are gigantic, several hundred feet long, serving 10, 12 auditoria. You need one or two ticket takers. The staffing is incredibly cheap relative to a single screen theater. And the other side is that you offer a diversity of choice. You can look up at that sign and see 10, 12 different films to choose from and pick the one that you like. So they went it from both sides, supply and demand.
Now, you talk about diversity. What always strikes me is that every multiplex has exactly the same movies.
Well, that strategy came later as Hollywood discovered, and it was really one single film that did it. It was Jaws in the summer of 1975, 15 years ago. And they realized that with television advertising flooding the airwaves 2-3 days beforehand, and people, Siskel and Ebert, and et cetera, et cetera, that you made much more sense to release it to 2,000-3,000 screens at a time.
Let's go back in history and look at some of the earlier movie theaters. Movie theaters used to be movie palaces. Why was there so much invested in or ornate palatial architecture?
It was part of the package. One must remember that in the early days, the turn of the century, movies were considered downright unrespectable. The censorship boards attacked the film industry. It was considered a kind of low-life, evil a kind of entertainment. I suppose the way I always describe it is it's sort of in the way of describing like professional wrestling today, is to say that I like professional wrestling. That kind of brands you as a particular kind of person. Same with movies. And the movie companies started to build what they considered so ornate, so vast, so wonderful an operation that nobody could dispute it. And they were right. Everybody fell in love with it by the 1930s.
Samuel Roxy Rothapel was the first movie palace king. What were his innovations?
He tried to add a kind of air of respectability to it. So he was very big into ushers, not just simply seating you, but there were people that would help take care of your children. There were people that would show you the way to these ornate, huge bathrooms. There would be special smoking rooms. They had staffs of, it seems remarkable today, of 100 ushers who were constantly on call trying to help you get into the right seat for the price that you paid when there were 4,000 different seats to choose from.
And the ushers had uniforms.
Oh, and they marched around. And he was in the Marine Corps, and he got the idea of changing the guard. And so every afternoon at 4 o'clock in his theater, whichever one he was operating at the time, There would be a changing of the guard a la Buckingham Palace, and people would come in the afternoon matinees just to see that.
You say that Balaban and Katz developed the formula that brought movie theaters to every main street in America. Who were they and what were their innovations?
They were basically one family. Sam Katz was married to Ida Balaban, and her brothers and the parents and everybody was involved. Started with a couple Nickelodeons in the south side of Chicago and really developed what I think was a system. Rather than simply just impressing you, they developed a system which filled the theaters 12 hours a day, 365 days a year. It really made it into a business rather than a kind of hit and miss. They located them where people lived, all around the city, depending on the subway and elevated lines. They built these ornate palaces that really knocked the socks off people of the 20s. And they were the first, absolutely the first, to innovate air conditioning. They publicized it so much that they got doctors to write prescriptions for women in their third trimester of pregnancy, requiring them to go to the movies in the afternoon to get out of the heat. Because really, in Chicago in the 20s, where else could you go? You couldn't go anywhere else. That was the only place that was air-conditioned, open to the public.
Now, I learned from your research that movie theaters refused to sell candy until the Depression.
Right. Again, that was part of the image. Candy, and especially popcorn, was considered smelly and low life and evil and associated with burlesque shows and associated with carnivals and hucksters. And they didn't want to have anything to do with that. That was the image they were trying to get away from. But once the Depression came and they saw people buying popcorn outside and candy outside, they decided they'd rather have the money than worry about their reputations.
In 1949, there was a decision that film studios couldn't own their own theaters. What effect did that have on the style of movie theaters?
Well, at that point, the theaters were pretty run down because of no repairs done in the Depression and no repairs during the war. And by separating them, it allowed the movie palaces to disintegrate. And so we started, sadly, in the late 50s, early 60s, tearing them down. In every major city, there were a row of them in downtown, which defined downtown. And in most cities now, there's only one or two left. And that really came about because there was no unity between Hollywood and the theaters to provide a device that Hollywood could reach Main Street. And also Main Street was moving out to the suburbs.
During the Reagan administration, the Paramount Decree of 1949 that studios couldn't own theaters was dropped. So how has that changed the relationship between studios and theaters?
Well, it signaled to the to both parties that they could join together and reform the system that had really defined the golden age of Hollywood. And so Columbia now today owns Lowe's theater chain, and Universal owns Cineplex Odeon, and et cetera, et cetera. And so in many ways, we're back to a system that Hollywood dictates. My favorite example, recent example, is a wonderful, delightful film called Field of Dreams, which is a baseball fantasy film, came out a couple of years ago with Kevin Costner. And since Universal controlled the Cineplex theaters that was often shown in, they kept the film in the theaters for many, many weeks beyond what a normal chain would have done, and in a way built the film back to a kind of sleeper hit that it was.
So I guess this is good if you have a film that's distributed by one of the majors.
Right.
I think this is probably bad if you have a film that's independent.
Absolutely. It's the worst era for independent filmmakers since, 10, 12, 15 years ago. They really don't have very much power. You're seeing it in controversial decisions about X ratings and distribution problems. You'll see more of it until somehow that changes. Hollywood wants the theaters for its own. The theaters establish the big hits, and then Hollywood uses that to market pay TV, home video, and all the other ancillary markets. So they're not about to lose the grip on those theaters if they can help it. And the only thing I can foresee that will change that is a different decision by the presidential administration. The Bush administration has indicated no reason to change it, but you never know with future administrations.
One thing I have to say about the multiplexes, it seems that more of them are popping their own popcorn as opposed to getting in these huge trash bags of pre-popped.
That's part of
popcorn.
The Cineplex thing. They're also, you probably noticed, having more and different kinds of food and snacks to purchase. It's not simply just M&Ms and Good and Plenty's anymore. It's dozens of kinds of things that you can choose from.
Now, what led them in that direction?
There are many reasons. I think one of the most important and overlooked reason is that they're really trying to lure adults, and by adults, for the movie industry, I define people that are people over the age of 30, to films. In the 70s, it was assumed once you hit the age 30, you wouldn't go to movies anymore. You would watch them on television. The 80s have proved that's incorrect. There have been Driving Miss Daisy, a lot of interesting films aimed at an adult audience, trying to keep baby boomers and even older folks keep coming back to the theaters. And it seems to have worked. Despite home video, despite pay cable and all the other alternatives that we now have offered in our homes, millions and millions of people are still going to the movie theaters.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for... It's been interesting and fun.
Douglas Gummery is a professor in the Department of Communication Arts at the University of Maryland. His essay on the history of American movie theaters is included in the new book, Seeing Through Movies, published by Pantheon.